Project Censored with Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we celebrate our one-year anniversary show as part of the Morning Mix. And we're going to jump right into the program today. And we're going to hear an interview that we did earlier this week with the leading scholar and activist for media reform in the United States, Professor Robert McChesney. So let's hear that interview recorded this Wednesday with Abby Martin of Media Roots. Here's Robert McChesney. We're joined this morning by Professor Robert McChesney. He is a research professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of several books on media, including the award-winning Rich Media, Poor Democracy. He is co-editor with Ben Scott of the collection Our Unfree Press, 100 Years of Radical Media Criticism. Robert McChesney, welcome.
Hey, Mickey, it's great to be here.
Thanks for agreeing to come on to our program. This is the one-year anniversary of the Project Censored Show on the Morning Mix, and we couldn't think of anybody we'd like to have more than you. You are a foremost expert on media reform, media analysis. Let's just jump straight in. You've written a lot about media ownership, media consolidation. How do you see things going, particularly in the last several years, since I know the focus of the media reform movement has often looked toward the FCC and towards some of these types of regulations. What's your estimation in the last several years on what's going on that front?
Well, I mean, there's a couple different fronts. There's, first of all, the state of our media, especially our news media in the United States, and I think the state of our news media in the United States is worse than ever. So we start there. And then there are the political battles over what to do about it. And Free Press, the group I helped start with John Nichols and some other folks that's been around for almost 10 years now, has worked on a variety of ways to try to address that crisis. And you're right, probably media ownership has been a central concern for the last 10 years, trying to have more owners. I think also trying to get funding for public and community media, so we have some alternative voices and non-commercial voices, has been one of the big battles. And then now the huge fight is over keeping the internet from being privatized by phone and cable companies and by the handful of monopolies that are sort of the feudal warlords of cyberspace, the Googles and Microsofts and AT&Ts and Verizons, that crowd. So we've been fighting on all those fronts with varying degrees of success. I think in virtually every case, polling shows the vast majority of Americans, when they're acquainted with the issue, are progressive and are very deeply concerned. But at the other side of the coin is we're dealing with lobbies that are extraordinarily wealthy and powerful and are used to getting their way with politicians and usually get their way with politicians.
And, you know, the recent AT&T T-Mobile situation, right? Mm-hmm. That's lauded as a victory by media reform people. But the trend has been, of course, you know, for every one of those kind of victories that go on, there are several other fronts where conglomeration and consolidation is still afoot. You mentioned, you know, Google and the internet, and as being a media historian, that you are, you've noticed these trends throughout the 20th century. New technologies, eventually work their way into the bureaucracies of government and so forth in a way that they can sort of attenuate the system to benefit private concerns and private interest over the public good. You see that happening with the internet.
Well, it has happened with the internet, and in certain ways it's even more insidious, because the internet adds a new dimension to the whole problem, which is that, you know, whereas broadcasting became highly concentrated, that was done exclusively through corrupt rules. We could have had policies which would have kept it significantly competitive, significantly local, even nonprofit, non-commercial. Those were all policy decisions that were made. In the case of the internet, you get what are called network effects, or what's called by economists Metcalfe's law, meaning that what we see in the internet is there are tremendous advantages to being the first one in and being successful in an area like Google with search, like Amazon with retail books, like eBay and Craigslist with selling stuff. And it has The irony is the internet, for all the talk of increasing competition, is more than anything the generator of more monopolies than we've ever seen in American history. It's just dominated by a handful of very huge companies that have sort of monopolistic turfs. They don't have to really fear direct competition.
Robert, this is Abby from Media Roots. I wanted you to follow up on that and talk about the Stop Online Piracy Act and what that's going to do to net neutrality as we see it.
Well, Stop Online Piracy Act, which is the latest act cooked up by the big media conglomerates that own the film studios and the music industry, is, you know, an extraordinarily egregious act. It would, in effect, mean that the internet would be a police state for culture, and that Google or any ISP would be held accountable for violations of copyright by anything they were participating in. It's an absurd and dangerous act. And it also represents really clearly the corruption of policymaking I talked about. Between 1998 and 2010, or until this year, in fact, in the last 13 years, the copyright industries, the big film studios, music companies, have spent approximately $1.3 billion lobbying in Washington, D.C., $1.3 billion to get more favorable copyright laws to protect them. And the other side of the coin, the people for copyright reform, trying to protect fair use, the public domain, little people, they've spent combined $1 million. So the ratio has been 1,300 to 1 in terms of the two sides of the forces. So that's why we've seen our copyright laws increasing in length and scope, completely in violation of the spirit and the intent of copyright, which is simply to encourage production of cultural fare, and then as soon as it's traded, turn it over as quickly as possible to the public domain. Now we've got basically permanent copyright for everything, and nothing's entered the public domain in generations. But what's happened with the Stop Online Piracy Act, and why it may not yet pass, is that in this case they have taken on not just librarians and educators and artists and musicians and hippies, but they've taken on Google and Facebook and Microsoft. So those lobbies are fighting back, and they do have a lot of influence in Washington with both political parties. And so I think there's a chance, a slight chance, that the Stop Online Piracy Act may not get all the way through, but it's really a case of King Kong versus Godzilla.
Taking that, again, we're still looking at, by the way, we're talking with Professor Robert McChesney, author most recently with John Nichols of The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. And that actually hits on the subject I want to get into, segueing from reform. You have another book prior to that called Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures in the Future of Media. Let's move beyond media reform. That was certainly a topic in Censored 2012 this year. In fact, you might find these words familiar. This is a quote from the preface. In the final analysis, each scholar, just like every citizen, has to take a long, hard look in the mirror and consider the following. If we act as if social change for the better is impossible, we guarantee it will be impossible. That's the long-standing human dilemma, except that in critical junctures, our powers increase, and the odds can swing dramatically in democracy's favor. We hold immense power in our hands. Let's not blow this opportunity. Let's have a real communication revolution. Those are your words. Where do we go beyond reform? How do we achieve this media revolution? You just mentioned that there's some slight hope or some inroads in working through our allegedly democratic institutions for media reform. But why wait? What else is going on right now on the ground do you see as part of the communication revolution?
Well, I think the argument I make in that book, and I've made all along, is that if you just abstract media and communication policy from the rest of the social life and the rest of the political realm and other political fights, there's a distinct limit to how much reform you can get, how much change you can get if you don't change anything else in society. And that realistically, both in the historical sense and just in theory, you know, it's not very plausible to think you're going to get very much change in our media system if none of the other institutions of society are altered. And our argument, or my argument, has always been that ultimately, if we're going to really have a quality media system. It's going to be part of a very broad reform or revolutionary, whatever term you want to use, process. It's going to radically transform all the core institutions of our society, of our political economy. And that's the only context that would make sense. And that's the sort of political muscle you would need in order to make dramatic changes and recreate our media and communication system. And, you know, this would sound like theoretical physics until quite recently. But I think now that we're in the midst of a severe crisis of our political economy, as our governing system is, you know, mired in the sewage of corruption that is plain to see, and our economy is failing, and we're seeing now in 2011, you know, a historic uprising of Americans, unlike anything we've seen in two generations. I think that we're at the moment now where we can start talking about a different type of political economy, a different type of communication system, a different type of social order, one that is sustainable and that prioritizes humanity and positive values over profit. And I think that's the sort of world we have to be in to get sort of media reform that I think it ultimately will promote informed self-government.
And Robert, what do you think the role of citizen journalism is in the media revolution?
I have mixed feelings about citizen journalism because generally when it's used for the most part, it just means unpaid journalism. That's what the term actually means. And, you know, I'm delighted to have citizen journalism in the sense that people participate in making journalism and doing that. But I think I'm not delighted at the idea that we're going to rely on journalism on volunteer labor, because I think that some of the journalism we need people who can actually eat, who can do it full-time, who are accountable for it, who are competing for it. And if we're relying purely on volunteer labor, I don't think that system works. I think it's great to have volunteer labor. I'm a blogger. I do citizen journalism on various stuff that I get compensated for. But I couldn't do that unless I had a paying gig otherwise. And so it's great that we have people involved, but if we get to the point where we're romanticizing people doing labor for not getting paid, I think we're entering a very treacherous area.
Bob, you're hitting on something there. Peter Phillips and I, you know, we also teach, and we view this as part of sort of, you know, teaching, having a public education position is really giving back to the commons, and we see that as part of our gigs, essentially. I mean, Project Censored is a 35-year project that works with students and members of the community. You know, and we couldn't do that either very well without having, you know, that kind of support that we do in terms of education. And I know you've certainly given a great deal over the years in that regard, including you have a radio show as well. So you're certainly on the front lines of communicating about the communication revolution. You mentioned briefly about the biggest changes in a couple generations. Of course, we're kind of dancing around the so-called Occupy movement. What do you think about the Occupy media, and how do you think this is shaping maybe public perception about the problems of big media and corporate media propaganda and bias?
What do you mean by Occupy media, Peter?
Occupy media, you know, the phrase the Occupy Wall Street movement.
There's
something. Well, we interviewed Michael Levitin a little while ago, who was one of the co-founders of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. What do you think about this in terms of the possibility of shaping public perception maybe away or being more skeptical of corporate media?
Hey, I'm all for it. I think that anything we can do to draw popular attention to what how appalling our news media are and how increasingly propagandistic they are and driven by a right-wing and corporate agenda, the better. I'm on board with that program.
And I mean, again, that's also part of this sort of citizen journalism in a way that it's activist oriented, people really trying to get the word out in terms of the public perspective. The whole meme of the 99% has actually been strikingly useful over the last several decades. It's been very difficult, it seems, for there to be some mass groundswell in terms of inroads against sort of the systemic repression that's going on and the encroaching police state, and we need media, we need a free press actually to really safeguard these issues. And as the press has degenerated, our democratic principles seem to have degenerated as well. In terms of getting the public informed and independent media and so-called alternative media, what sources do you trust overall? What sources could people go to, given that we do have technology and we do have the internet and it hasn't been completely controlled and shut down at this juncture? Where is the hope for people to get accurate information, do you think?
Well, that's a great question, and there, I don't know if I've got a great answer. I do know, for one thing, and listeners to this program should understand, having community radio stations like this one, like WEFT in Champaign-Urbana, WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, these are an absolute lifeline for sanity. And, you know, in the Wisconsin uprising in Madison, for example, in the first 4 months of 2011, and I live in Madison most of the time, even though I teach in Illinois, but I was here for the whole semester. I wasn't teaching. WORT, the community station, was absolutely covering it. Where no other news media went. It was on top of the story. And I don't know what we would have done. That movement wouldn't have survived. It would have been very different without WORT, I can tell you that. So I'd say, for starters, community radio, community media, enhancing it, supporting it, doing whatever you can to keep it rocking and rolling. It's going to be ever more important. And it's not just radio, because it's all online, too. So it's an internet presence, digital. But in the movement coming forward, this sort of media is absolutely essential. So I rely on it. I use it for breaking news, for all sorts of programming. Online, there's actually considerable good material. I will mention one author specifically, because I think he's probably the one person who came through the internet who's been, in my view, the greatest journalist of our age, who's Glenn Greenwald, who writes for Salon.com. And I just think, you know, if the only consequence of the internet was it got Glenn Greenwald to leave law and become a journalist, the internet is not historically worthwhile, because Glenn's work is so stellar. But there's lots of good journalists beyond that. And I have lots of friends, people who aren't friends who I read. But I would say this. Our journalism, as a rule, though, has got lots of problems, because there's lots of stuff not getting covered, because, you know, you can't cover it. The government's keeping stuff secret. It requires skill and support to do. You can't really do it as a citizen journalist on your own. Citizen journalists can cover a demonstration. They can't necessarily cover the U.S. invasion plans for East Asia that are passed in the Pentagon. That's a different type of journalism that we need desperately, that is hard to get. And so, you know, I think that what I find is that sometimes we have to rely on elite journalism, Business Week, Forbes, Fortune, Economist, and that stuff's all done with the prejudice of the class audience that it's intended for. But it's oftentimes the best journalism we have out there for a lot of stuff, because it's written to the people who run the world, who own it, who operate it, who manage it. And those people, they need to know what's actually going on so they can manage the world. And sometimes that's why I advise people to go for coverage of certain stories. And then you just have to decipher out propagandistic class edge to it. But that's oftentimes where you get the best information.
We're speaking with Bob McChesney, professor at Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, a communications professor, author of numerous books on media, co-founder of Free Press. Just wanted to touch one more time on the idea of moving beyond reform. Free Press, of course, is a reform movement. Project Censored's been to several of the conferences over the years. Most recently, everyone met in Boston. Again, this is a very important front as far as the media democracy movement goes. But again, you've also mentioned that it has these institutional impediments, and it has these limits to what can be done. So again, outside of that, what would your advice be, or what could you advocate for doing other than relying on establishment changes or systemic changes? What else is going on the ground, and what else do you see in terms of fostering a media democracy movement?
Well, I mean, I believe, you know, people doing media like you're doing on this show, or the activists are doing, is a key part of it. It's not enough, but it's a multi-front fight. And I've always thought that and always argued that, but it's never, you don't put all your chips on one number. You're fighting a lot of different fronts, a lot of different battles. And so doing media, being a media activist, all of that's very important. You're doing education, teaching, is very important as well. I would say, though, right now, at the moment we're in, it's a little different than earlier periods. Now, I think we're in a period of dramatic, you know, we can't fight last year's war, the last war. I think that the type of politics that dominated from say 1978 or 1980 to 2008. That era is behind us, and I think people rely on that era to make sense of the present and the future. But that was a different time. So we're entering a period now where we're seeing dramatic shifts in how young people view the United States, they view capitalism, they view the world. And it shifts that I think portend the possibility of tremendous progressive change. And changes that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago, 5 years ago, not to mention 20 years ago. And I think it's an extraordinarily exciting moment politically because of that, not just for media. Media are closely wrapped up in it, part of the cocktail of institutions that are going to be under review. But I think the key thing for all of us to keep in mind is that we are historically at a moment now of the most interesting times of my adult life. I'm 58 years old. And I think that what happens in the next 5 or 10 years globally will go a long way toward shaping, you know, where the species is heading. And so it's a very exciting moment. It's a very scary moment. But the upside is an upside we haven't seen in a very long time.
Very true, Robert. And you know, we need a communication revolution. We also need the mediums of communication in order to relay this message and have this transcendental shift of consciousness that you're talking about. And that's why this is so crucial. And we thank you so much for your excellent work and for coming on our anniversary show. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Well, congratulations to all of you on your show and what you've done for the last 35 years. I'm looking forward to reading your new book, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we've been in conversation with Professor Robert McChesney, author most recently of The Death and Life of American Journalism, with John Nichols, also author of Communication Revolution, The Problem of Media. Again, if you're really interested in media, you should certainly know who Robert McChesney is. Again, thanks for joining us, Bob, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Great. See you later.
Thanks. Special thanks to Professor Robert McChesney for taking some time with us this week to talk about his important work and moving beyond media reform. After the Workweek Radio, we're going to be hearing from Cindy Peister on The Dark Side of Eldora, A Soldier in the Shadows.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Morning Mix at KPFA. This is Peter Phillips, and with me in studio is Mickey Huff. Circulating on the Internet now is a new film, On the Dark Side in Eldora, which focuses on U.S. Army Ranger John Needham's experience in Iraq, where he witnessed war crimes and some rather grim atrocities. He tried to blow the whistle on that, and he, in the process of being there, was blown up like 14 times, had traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress, shrapnel throughout his body, ended up back here in the U.S. Under some dire situations, and is now deceased. We have on the line the producer from the film, On the Dark Side in Eldora, Cindy Peister. Cindy, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great to have you, Cindy.
Thank you.
And also on the line is Michael Needham. He's John Needham's father, and both are going to talk about the film and the importance of this very, very serious accusations against U.S. military. Cindy, tell us about the film and how people can see it.
Oh, thank you, Peter. First of all, I just want to thank you and Mickey for having us on, and Project Censored for all the incredible work that you've done to get stories like this out to the public that they wouldn't otherwise know. Actually, I did more than produce it. I wrote the script and directed it, so I'm really familiar with the material. We met Michael in March of this year. I did an interview with him on independent media, Pulse TV and Maverick Media out of Ventura. And we were all stunned. The crew and I were all stunned by Michael's presentation of his son's story. John's story is so tragic, and Mike himself is so genuine. And the atrocities are so vicious and so dark. We made a commitment on the spot to Mike that we would do whatever it took to help him get this story out. We thought that it would be a lot better if big media put it out. They have millions of viewers, but Mike had already had a number of disappointments in that regard. We did sit it out and wait for Time Magazine to release the photos and stories that they had said they would, but they didn't do it. And, of course, and then we went full speed ahead on getting the film out after CBS produced its show on John's story November 12th. They did cover aspects of veterans' concerns that were really important, but they didn't really focus on atrocities. And Mike and I had really wanted to get this story out to the public. We just felt it was in the public interest and it had to be done. So we just pushed forward at that point. We want accountability for these crimes, and we want John's story to be out there. We had to turn to the activist community to distribute the film, and it went out through the Occupy movements, even across Europe. David Swanson got the film and John's letter to the military authorities, in which he had tried to inform them of the atrocities. He got that put out on Truth Out, and now Project Censored is putting out. We really appreciate your support. We did get hundreds of thousands of hits and 20-something plays just the first 5 days.
Cindy, what are the how can people see this on online?
Okay,
at this
if
point?
We go to our Vimeo website, it's http://vimeo.com/
V-I-M-E-O. And I think if you Google On the Dark Side in Aldura, A-L-D-O-U-R-A, that you're going to find this because it's at Maverick Media and Pulse TV.
Exactly, and it'll probably come out from the Truth Out site.
That's great, and we'll probably have links to it as well on our site.
Thank you.
Online with us also is Michael Needham, John's father. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much for coming on. I saw the video this week. It's shocking. It's a tragedy of what happened to your son. It's also a tragedy of what was happening to other Iraq people in Baghdad, Iraqis, who were killed in front of him. And he tries to blow the whistle and reports that. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, basically, my son grew up in San Clemente, California. He is one of five children. He's my middle son. And John was always a very active, athletic, he was a very high achiever, very fearless person. He had a number of different opportunities. He was in the pro surfing circuit in Southern California. And in 2005, he had actually won the open men's competition in a contest in Southern California that went on for 4 months. So he was pretty much on a fast track to pro surfing, and he was also very interested in art and in music. So all of the, within a period of time, he started getting involved in watching different shows like Band of Brothers and, Saving Private Ryan. We lived in San Clemente, only minutes from a Marine base, Camp Pendleton. And this overwhelming kind of nationalistic, feeling that the country was going through at that time motivated him to think about, going into the military and going and fighting for, quote-unquote, our freedom. So long story short, basically, I'm an I'm a Vietnam veteran, ex-Army officer, and I tried to talk him out of it, but he went ahead and made that choice. Well, fast forward, he went through all this training, he got deployed to Iraq in 2006 with a unit out of Fort Carson called the 212, 2nd Infantry Division, 12th Regiment, 2nd Combat Team. And that particular unit became very, very infamous for these types of actions. While they were in Iraq, his unit was an apocalyptic now type of unit where the lieutenant colonel, battalion commander, use these tactics of basically terrorizing and murdering and dismembering bodies. If anybody's familiar with the trophy murders that were in Afghanistan, this makes that look like a small scale operation. So with the time we have on the phone right now, what I'd like everybody to do is look at the video on Vimeo. And the real important thing here is that as a parent, as a father or someone's husband or son or uncle, people need to know what the reality of what happened in Iraq. And this is not an isolated case. This is an entire battalion. in southern Baghdad that basically targeted, murdered, and racketeered basically an entire neighborhood through the leadership of the 2nd Infantry Division that was commanding at the time. The atrocities are real. I got the photographs. I presented them. I went through a number of situations of dealing with the government, dealing with the Army, dealing with Department of Defense, the White House, trying to get people to take a look and take action. But basically, it was covered up. I had major publications that were on the story, and at time of release, I was told that they weren't going to do it. In the case of the Washington Post, I was told that they were not going to run the story because they were basically told by the Pentagon that if they run the story, that they would not have access, like other agencies, to breaking news. They were basically, you know, telling them that if you run this story, we're going to blackball you.
It's elite sourcing is a form of censorship. We're speaking with Cindy Peister and Michael Needham about a new video on the dark side in Aldora, A Soldier in the Shadows, addressing soldiers' war crimes allegations in Iraq atrocity photos. Michael, I'm sorry for interrupting you. I just wanted to point out, you were talking about the Washington Post. CBS also reported on this. CBS did a program on this, and when they contacted the Army, it was such that the they claimed that war crimes did not occur, though CBS also stated that the report was redacted and incomplete with 111 pages withheld. And the report claimed that when soldiers were asked about specific photos, showing an individual with his brains pulled out atop a military vehicle, and they were told, quote, "We didn't have any body bags that day, so we put him on the hood of the vehicle for transport." I mean, this is the kind of thing that you're talking about and the kind of thing you're saying the Washington Post doesn't want to talk about.
Well, yeah, and basically when we're talking about that particular instance, which is one of hundreds, and is documented with photos and with collaborating soldiers' stories, is just a juvenile, sophomoric way of blowing us off, okay? I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail right now because it's a radio show and we're limited on time, but being former Army, I understand, you know, what they need to do. You would never drive a body around on a hood. And what really happened at that time was that Iraqi was standing on the street and was shot and killed point blank in the head. They drug him on the hood. They took his brains out. And then they drove around the neighborhood with an interpreter blaring out threats in Arabic that if the citizens of the mullah or the neighborhood in Aldora did not cooperate with them, that that's what their end would be. They were terrorists themselves. They were killing civilians, robbing, stealing, just out of control. It really is like an apocalyptic now type of situation. The story with my son is even more interesting because basically I documented this thing from the very first minute he went in the Army. And I don't want, like I said, we have limited amount of time. But every claim we make, everything we say, we have dates, times, photographs, collaboration.
Michael, I think this is a really important story. John, your son tried to tell this. He was subsequently came back to the U.S., is now deceased. There's circumstances, all of this, which need to be investigated and brought forward. We wish we had more time today to really talk with you about more about this. People can see this film online. It's called On the Dark Side in Aldora, A Soldier in the Shadows. You can watch it online. It's going to be Cindy. Are you still there?
Yes, I am. Sure.
And you're continuing to work on this film. Is that correct?
Well, we do have hopes to add some more interviews to make it a little meatier, but we haven't got that confirmed yet. But we do hope to do that. Yes.
Well, if I can interject for 1 second, we're not done with the story yet. I am still dealing with the VA in his death, and at this point in time, we're not guaranteed on exactly how he died.
Michael, we're going to follow up on this with you and with Cindy, and this is not going to go away. Thank you very much for being on the air with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Thank you, Mickey.
Thank you.
See you, Cindy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. We're also joined in studio by Interim General KPFA Manager Andrew Phillips for our one-year show. Andrew.
Oh, this is a pat on the back and a thank you to you guys for doing such stellar work over the important work such as we're hearing today. It's really great that you've pitched in at KPFA, and we're proud to have you. And I know that your program, Mickey and Peter, is going out nationally also, creeping out there, because it is important that people hear this. Look, I want to take this opportunity to wish everybody, our members and all of you listening, a very happy and prosperous holiday. Hang tight. It's going to be a great year next year, very exciting. We've got some interesting projects coming up, and you guys in the studio and Anthony especially, great work, and someone on the board I haven't met yet. But thank you, everybody, and have a great
day. Thanks, Jax. Thanks for coming in, Andrew.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. We're going to round out the program today. We also did a brief interview with our sometimes co-host, Abby Martin. She's also a member of the Media Freedom Foundation, co-founder of Media Roots. So I had an opportunity to sit down and talk with Abby about the work she does, certainly the work she's done covering the local Occupy movement. So here's a brief interview with Abby Martin of Media Roots. For the one-year anniversary program here at the Morning Mix, the Project Centered Show, we wanted to actually talk to one of our co-hosts, Abby Martin of Media Roots, who's also a board member at Media Freedom Foundation. Abby, let's just hear some of your reflections on the past year. What have you been doing with Media Roots, some of the highlights that you've done here on the show, and some of the work you're doing with Project Centered?
Well, Mickey, I started Media Roots about a year and a half ago, starting off as just a news aggregate, just to have a vast collection of underreported news, kind of what you guys were already doing in my own way, and adding kind of a personality to it. And then over time, it just turned into a citizen journalism project where people continually started pulling information from all over the world and submitting contributions, and it ended up being way bigger than I imagined, and getting involved with Project Censored and now intertwining the two is really exciting. Occupy Oakland, when that took off, I was on the ground every day when things were happening, and that's when I really, the citizen journalism aspect of it really shined, because I was able to tell the story of what was happening from the ground up, instead of top down. And we saw, you know, obviously the corporate news got that a lot wrong, said that people, you know, the crowd control methods that they use, those draconian crowd control methods, were warranted, when really, you know, it was up to citizen journalism to really tell the story of what was going on at that time.
And we've certainly been fortunate to have been working with you over the past year. We certainly look forward to doing more of that. What you're describing sounds a lot like the name of the website, you know, the organization, mediaroots.org. Media Roots, radical, meaning go to the roots and have a bottom-up kind of construction of a people's narrative. That's what you're getting at.
Absolutely. We see the top-down corporate consolidation and control of the message. It's institutionalized. It's not organic. And Media Roots is really... It's from the ground up. It's true activism. It's true grassroots journalism, where you're getting the story from each other. Like Robert McChesney said in the interview, it's not paid. Yeah, we accept donations, but we're not influenced by any corporate donor or any sort of dogmatic principles. We are for the truth. We're completely unbiased. We report from outside party lines, just like Project Censored does. And it's really important to have that.
And hitting on the notion of reform, Elizabeth Cady Stanton once wrote, "Reformers who are always compromising have not yet grasped the idea that truth is the only safe ground to stand upon." And of course, we won't pretend that there is only one truth. In terms, you know, there are many different ways people can interpret things. But one of the biggest problems that we have in our media structure here is that people don't get all of the relevant facts. And of course, the bottom up, the vernacular view, the media route going straight to the streets, so to speak, that's a lot often the view that's really missing. And certainly at Media Roots, you've been doing that. You've been covering Occupy Oakland, and you're also working with some people on a film about Occupy Wall Street. Is that correct? Could you talk to us at least briefly about some of that and maybe some of the narrative? What's the Media Roots connection there? And what do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, there's a great film. It's called the Occupy Wall Street Collaborative Film Project, based in New York, run by a woman named Audrey. And it's pretty much this whole concept that we're talking about, citizen journalism. They're pulling together everyone's footage across the world that has been participating in covering the Occupy Wall Street movement and putting it together in a collaborative project. I'm going to be part director. I'm submitting my Occupy Oakland footage exclusively to represent this area. And it's just a really exciting grassroots project with a bunch of journalists who are going to get together and put together a citizen journalism film highlighting this movement.
We've been talking with Abby Martin of Media Roots. Also, you're familiar with Abby. She joins us here occasionally Friday mornings on the Morning Mix. So thanks again, Abby Martin, for all of your work. Thanks for joining us again today to celebrate our one-year anniversary show, and we look forward to working with you in the year ahead.
It's a great pleasure, Mickey. Thanks so much for Project Censored and everything you do.
And that does it for today's Project Censored show on Pacific Radio. Again, I'm Mickey Huff, and in studio with my illustrious co-host, Dr. Peter Phillips. Peter, it's been a great year. We look forward to doing more ahead with Free Speech Community Radio.
Thank you, Mickey, and thank you to everyone at KPFA for having us on this year, and we look forward to continuing.
That's right. Thanks again to Anthony Fest. Thanks today for Jax. Thanks for Kirsten Thomas, who's often on the board helping us out. Thanks, too, to Andrew Phillips for joining us. Thanks to Carrie Corr. Thanks to Arlene Engelhardt. And most of all, thanks to all of you, the listeners and supporters of Community Free Speech Radio. Continue to occupy media in the new year to come, and we'll see you next time.